Dentists'
major
options
support
for
only
same
a
day replacement of missing and compromised teeth. Information online at BICON.com or at 800-88-BICON.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. Some of the teams that appear in the NCAA basketball tournament earn their berths by winning a conference championship. Others compile such impressive records that everybody agrees they ought to go to the dance, but picking the teams that fill out the brackets after the favorites have settled into their slots is the responsibility of the NCAA Selection Committee, a group of people who must take into account not only a team's record, but how difficult its schedule has been and various other much more obscure variables. Joining me now to explain the challenge faced by that group is Doug Elgin, commissioner of the Missouri Valley Conference. Until 2002, he was a member of the NCAA Selection Committee. Mr. Elgin, welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you, Bill. My pleasure.
Okay, Stanford is in. St. Joseph's, with only one loss, is in. Duke, Gonzaga, these are easy choices. How many teams are so-called locks to make the tournament every year?
I think in most years there are probably somewhere between 15 and 25 teams that are considered locks, probably the lower end of that number in most years.
So a whole lot of teams that everybody has to talk about. When you get down to those second tier of teams, which variable do you examine first?
You really take a long look at the conference that team plays in, that the conference competition, and the non-conference schedule that's put together independently by each institution's athletic director or basketball coach or both. You look at the entire season profile as you compare team versus team. When you come right down to it, no matter how objective the data is you're looking at, the selection and seeding of teams really comes down to the subjective evaluations of 10 people. Each of those people will spend an enormous amount of time during the regular season watching basketball on television, having discussions with people about teams.
You know, watching lots of basketball games on cable TV, nasty work, but somebody has to do it. Is it fun to be a member of this committee, or does it become drudgery?
Well, first of all, it's fun, it's prestigious, it's probably the greatest honor that can come to an athletics administrator in his or her career. But more than that, there's a terrible responsibility that you feel when you're on that committee to learn as much as you can so that you can properly evaluate the teams going into a selection weekend. And I guess the biggest charge that committee faces during selection weekend is selecting the 34 teams that are the best teams in the country, regardless of conference affiliation, regardless of brand names, based on what they did that season more than anything else.
It sounds as if maybe you're glad that your term on the selection committee is over and you can sit back and just be a basketball fan.
Not at all. I would have accepted tenure on that committee. It was a tremendous opportunity, and I can remember on my last Final Four weekend, Mike Trangisi, who was the chair of the committee when I was on it during a two-year stretch, he was the Big East commissioner and still is, he took me aside and said, Doug, I promise you, you will not miss this. And I don't miss it, except for certain periods of the year, and certainly selection weekend is probably the weekend and the time that you miss it most of all. But I know those people are working hard, they're sleep-deprived, they're doing the very best that they can to put together the very best tournament bracket that they possibly can.
I gather it's probably impossible to make everybody happy.
It really is, and certainly there's a saying that I can remember my boss, Vic Bubas, who was commissioner of the Sun Belt Conference, used to come back from the selection weekend and chuckle when people would complain about their seating, and he would say, you can play yourself out of a bad seed, but you can't play your way into the tournament after the selection weekend. So those who have the luxury of complaining about their seed, I think, are few and far between. And I think most coaches and most teams are solely focused on the task at hand after those announcements are made.
All right. I can't let you go without asking you for a pick in this year's tournament, strictly for entertainment purposes, of course.
I would have to go with the dark horse pick that many others probably will not come out with, one of two. One would be Northern Iowa, which is a team that came out of the Missouri Valley Conference championship game.
There you go.
Pardon the plug here. But also I would have to say that Southern Illinois, a team that nearly went unbeaten in Missouri Valley Conference play is another team to be reckoned with. And if you look past those, you might look at the Stanfords, the Dukes, the Kentuckys. Those teams obviously will be heavily favored and highly regarded as the announcements are made on Sunday.
Doug Elgin is the commissioner of the Missouri Valley Conference, an utterly unbiased commissioner, I might add. He's also a former member of the NCAA Men's Basketball Tournament Selection Committee. Mr. Elgin, thank you very much for speaking with me.
I appreciate it, Bill. Thank you.
Georgetown University established itself as a basketball power by virtue of its appearance in the 1982 NCAA championship game. 2 years earlier, crosstown rival Catholic University, the other mid-sized, academically strong Catholic college in Washington, D.C., had dropped out of Division I and become a Division III school. As producer Richard Paul reports, the different approaches of the two schools to basketball over the last 22 years have yielded somewhat similar results.
Ewing steps in, and Perkham steps in, and the 1982 44th Annual Championship Game is underway.
The University of North Carolina would go on to win the NCAA title in 1982, but March 29th of that year marked a victory for the men's basketball program at Georgetown University as the Hoyas returned to the NCAA final for the first time since 1943. But how and why did Georgetown decide to re-emphasize basketball in the intervening years? According to this highlight video from 1989, the winning formula is a simple one.
Achieving this level of success had taken years of hard work and dedication.
But according to Bill Shaplin, Georgetown's senior sports communication director, there's more to it than that.
There is an illusion that there is a decision made after the fact that something has happened. You say, well, somebody must have decided to do that. And it's a much more organic process than that.
Georgetown, like all top-level college basketball programs, needed three things in order to compete at the Division I level, according to Stanford University economics professor Roger Knoll.
The first thing you need is a facility that's large enough to sell enough tickets so that you can finance the program. The second thing you need is a big-time coach. And the third thing you need is a recruiting apparatus so that you can get at least one good and one okay player per year.
Georgetown did all of that, starting in 1972 when they hired head coach John Thompson. Leonard Shapiro is a columnist for the Washington Post and the author of Big Man on Campus, an unauthorized biography of John Thompson. Shapiro says shortly after Thompson got there, he went to the Georgetown administration and said,
look, if you want to have a program that can compete on a national level, you're going to have to help me get kids in here who you might not ordinarily have admitted. They lowered the standards, basically, to get in kids who normally could not have gotten in there.
From the beginning, Thompson began recruiting academically motivated kids from academically poor inner-city schools. Shapiro points out that Georgetown did provide a strong support system run by a former nun to help the kids in the classroom, but there were problems. Take Bill Lynn, a talented 6-foot 10-inch forward from D.C.'s Spring Garden High School, who committed to Georgetown in Thompson's first year.
There was a concern that some of his transcripts at Spring Garden had been doctored to allow him to have the minimum requirements to go to Georgetown. There were coaches who had also recruited Billy Lynn and said that there was no way that the transcripts had got Billy Lynn into Georgetown were the ones they saw when they were trying to recruit him for their schools and threatened Thompson to basically, you know, you can't use this guy. We're gonna turn you in on this guy. And Thompson said, if you know you do that to me, you know, I'm gonna get you on some other thing. And they basically let it slide.
Rebound Ewing. Ewing holds it in his arms, gets it off to Reggie Williams.
Georgetown went on to recruit future NBA stars Reggie Williams, David Wingate, Eric Sleepy Floyd, and future NBA Hall of Famer Patrick Ewing, who led the Hoyas to three Final Four berths from 1982 to 1985 and the national title in 1984.
That's for the iron, dumps it off to Wingate, lays it up and in, and Georgetown now leads 51-40, John, with 35 seconds to go. Wingate with 11, and that should just about do it.
And we'll look forward to a Georgetown-Houston national title game coming up on Monday night.
According to Leonard Shapiro, the notoriety and revenue generated by Georgetown's basketball success actually helped Georgetown raise the academic quality of their overall student body, especially when it came to African Americans.
Black kids around the country who might not normally have ever even thought about attending Georgetown University, now all of a sudden said, you know, I like what they're doing with the basketball team. It looks like a place where blacks may feel more comfortable and are more prevalent than they used to be. I'm going to apply to that school. And we're talking about kids, you know, the best and the brightest.
Substitutes for Catholic as the seniors get one final round of applause from the D.C. crowd here at the Salem Civic Center.
In the early 70s, precisely the moment Georgetown was moving towards the big time, Catholic University made the decision to go the other way. According to Catholic's president, Father David O'Connell, the decision was primarily economic.
Basically, the school didn't want to expend the funds. That's the heart of the decision, to spend the funds on the things that were going to produce the most for the institution and for its future. And the decision was made that that was not going to be athletics, it was going to be the academic side of the university.
In 1982, the same year Georgetown made the Final Four, Catholic chose to drop their Division I status and move to Division III.
Picked up by Catholic, and that's it! Catholic University, five seniors, 100 wins in a national championship as the Cardinal players point to the heavens.
But Catholic didn't drop their commitment to athletics, and in 2001 they capped years of solid performance with an appearance in the NCAA Division III championship. O'Connell says his school's athletic performance at the Division III level has thrilled him and much of the campus as a whole.
When our basketball team won the national championships in Division III in 2001, I was just as happy as I would have been if it was Division I. And those kids were just as happy, just as psyched, and just as proud of their experience. And that's what it's all about. It's not just winning that is important here. I mean, I have no jealousy whatsoever about a Division I program.
Catholic and Georgetown will both be missing their respective NCAA tournaments this year, but it's still fair to say that, all things considered, after 25 years, both schools are happy with their decision. For Only a Game, I'm Richard Paul in Washington, D.C.
It's 18 minutes past the hour. The rare American robin shouldn't have been in Grimsby at all. The bird had strayed thousands of miles from the customary migratory path of its species, but thousands of British bird watchers were delighted that the songbird had appeared in their bailiwick, and they flocked, so to speak, to the robin's nest on an industrial site in the aforementioned Grimsby for a look. The fortunate among them looked quickly, for even as they focused their cameras to get evidence of the unusual sighting, a sparrowhawk dove into their frames and ate the robin up. It was a terrible moment, mourned Graham Appleton of the British Trust for Ornithology. The bird did not live to enjoy its moment of fame. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, making the cut on a big league roster, part the second. But first, most Americans don't know the difference between a gully and a slip in the world of cricket. But those interested in diplomatic relations between nuclear neighbors India and Pakistan will want to stay tuned, because today in Karachi, Pakistan, the Indian cricket team plays the first match of the first full tour of Pakistan in 15 years. Before today's match, I spoke with Richard Williams, who covers sports for The Guardian newspaper, and he's in Karachi covering the tour. I asked him to describe the security in Pakistan.
Well, I've seen more guns in the last couple of days in Lahore and Karachi than I've seen in a lifetime of watching Western movies, I think. And it was very interesting to see the captain of the Indian team sitting, having a cup of tea in his hotel with two armed guards standing over him. And then when he wanted to go to the elevator to go to his room, a walk of about, 15 feet or something, five more bodyguards came and stood around him just for the walk across the hotel lobby. It's extraordinary in that respect.
Well, this is fascinating to me, because players for both teams said before the match that when they enter the grounds, they'll be thinking only about cricket, not diplomacy, not international relations, not dangers. But with the kind of situation you're describing, can they really keep their minds on the game?
Oh, I think they they probably can. I mean, cricket in these parts is always pretty lively, big-time cricket. So, you know, they're used to a certain amount of the kind of atmosphere that wouldn't be normal in, say, a cricket match in England, I can tell you. But, of course, you know, they're such big stars here. They're like movie stars or, you know, in America, basketball stars. They have that kind of stature that really, you know, their performance is very important. It's very important for each of these teams to beat the other. So I do actually think when they get onto the pitch that that's what they'll be thinking about.
There were predictions made before the tour began that 10,000 Indian cricket fans would make the journey to see these games, that offices would be shut down because workers wouldn't be going to work anyway. They'd be watching the games. Hotels would be overflowing. Have all of these predictions come true?
They're certainly coming true in Pakistan, yes. I think, you know, in each of the cities where the games are being played, the city is being given a day off so that the ones who haven't got tickets can watch on televisions or big screens which are being set up, or even cinemas. And there is said to be the probability of a television audience on the subcontinent of 400 million people.
The 33,000-seat stadium will be filled to capacity for today's match, but there were only 1,000 fans on hand for Thursday's warm-up match between India and a less popular, perhaps less talented Pakistani team. In your article on that match, you described it as being, quote, a little like a London audience refusing to buy tickets to see the Beatles because the Rolling Stones were not sharing the bill. Why did fans stay away?
I think several reasons. I do think that Pakistani fans are really interested more in their own team than in the Indian team. Mm-hmm. And India, in that warm-up match, were playing very much a Pakistan second team. The other reason was that originally it was announced that the match was going to be played behind closed doors with no crowd at all, just as an exercise, partly for the players, but partly for the security forces to get their eye in on their precautions. But then, very, very late in the day, they announced that the public could come in. So I think, you know, part of the reason was people simply didn't know about it.
Though India has never won a test match in Pakistan, I'm told that these two particular teams are relatively evenly matched. Who do you expect to come out on top when this is all over?
It's very hard to say. They're evenly matched, but in very different ways. Cricket is divided more or less between batting and bowling. And the Indians have wonderful batsmen, and Pakistan have ferocious bowlers. It's shaping up as a contest that way, but we'll have to see. Cricket can always produce surprises. So I think you would have to favour the balance of history, and probably the balance of form suggests Pakistan.
Well, if we want to apply a baseball term to this, good pitching always beats good hitting, so we'd have to go with Pakistan on that score, right?
I think you probably would. Probably true.
Richard Williams covers sports for The Guardian newspaper. Richard, thank you very much for speaking with me.
That's a pleasure. Thank you.
The BBC's Adam Minot is across the border in Delhi, India. Adam, who's your pick?
I think it's going to be pretty even, but I guess as I'm on this side of the border, I ought to go with India.
It's been said that of the 1 billion people on the Indian subcontinent, about 999 million are cricket fans. How important is this tour to the people of India and Pakistan?
I mean, it is literally not an overstatement to say that cricket is akin to a religion in India. Every young boy and girl, indeed, that's born in India wants to be a cricket star. So the attention that's being paid to these cricket matches, that there are 5 one-day games and 3 test matches, which last 5 days, spread over the course of the next 4 weeks or so, it will absorb every person in this nation. They will be hanging on every single ball that's bowled, every single shot that's played. And, of course, there are major diplomatic overtones as well.
The tour looked as if it might be cancelled until the Prime Minister of India stepped in to override security concerns and suggestions that the tour should be delayed until after India's upcoming elections. But politicians on both sides have seemed so eager to be photographed supporting this effort.
You're right. In fact, the last Indian that the Indian cricket team saw before leaving for Pakistan was the Prime Minister himself. He sent them on their way saying, go there and win not just matches, but win hearts as well. It is a very, very important political event as well. And I think that's really because As you know, India and Pakistan came very close to war 12 months ago over the disputed region of Kashmir. And I think if you look at the positions of the two countries, they are so completely irreconcilable. Both claim Kashmir as their own territory. You know, there is no chance of them reaching an early compromise over Kashmir. So the very fact that some sort of diplomatic process, be it on the cricket field, has begun, that's what's important about bringing these two countries closer together. There's also enhanced trade happening at the moment. We've now got bus links between the two countries. So this is all part of the process, and there's no doubt at all that the cricket is in the vanguard.
The positive developments that you've mentioned notwithstanding, there is a certain level of care being exercised. Indian officials say that they will take their players home at the first sign of violence, and Pakistani police already have had to use force to control an unruly crowd lining up to buy tickets for the first match. What's the likelihood that the tour makes it to its scheduled end in mid-April?
Well, I mean, I hesitate to say this, but I would be surprised if it was disrupted by trouble. I mean, that said, you know, you don't get a cricket match between these two nations without an over-exuberant crowd, so that there's bound to be a bit of crowd trouble. I don't think that peoples in either country really want to disrupt this. I think that so much political capital has been invested in this that I say, and I say this with my fingers crossed, that I think it is unlikely to be disrupted by violence.
Adam Minot is the South Asian correspondent for the BBC. Adam, thank you very much for joining me.
Great to talk to you.
In his first audio journal, 14-year pro baseball veteran Adam Hysdew spoke candidly of how he hoped to crack the Red Sox 2004 lineup. Hysdew was drafted in the first round by the Giants in 1990, but he has never made an opening day major league roster. Part two of our series begins with Hysdew saying goodbye to his family at his Arizona home before his trip to Fort Myers, Florida, and the initial days of training camp.
I'll see you in about 13 days, okay?
Okay.
What is that? Did you see your hair?
Yes, I saw it.
That is a piece of work.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Zach will miss you. This is the mixed emotion day. Waking up for the last time in your home. Leaving to Florida today, this is a tough time. But with the promise and excitement of a new season. So it's about 6:30 a.m., getting ready to go to the airport.
These noises always remind me of spring training. Buses, jets, people talking, goodbyes, saying goodbye to my family for a couple weeks before they come to Florida. But I'm at the airport and the emotions are mixed and they're troubling and they're exciting and all that stuff. So we'll see what happens. Bye-bye.
Today was check-in day. Got a quick reminder of where I stood on the pecking order, just playing catch with Pokey Reese. And, you know, one of the coaches comes by and says hi to everybody, gives hugs and everything, and invites Pokey to hit with the catchers, except didn't extend the invitation to me, which is really no big deal. It's just one of those things that lets you know that, you know what, you're not an established guy, and so you're going to have to suck it up. It's later on in the day, on Thursday. I spoke with Bill Miller today. He was, it was just kind of good to hear someone's perspective. He was last year's batting champ.
All right.
Yeah, this is Bill Miller giving his explanation on hopes for the late additions to the team and what he might hope for.
Well, to start in the outfield, I think you're looking for a guy that's very versatile, that can play all three positions. Obviously, that has a strong arm and now give you quality at-bats and kind of understanding his role and ready to help the team in any way he can.
Today is the first day of live batting practice. First on my docket was Tim Wakefield, which is actually a good way to start spring because you're typically a little behind. So you get to face a guy that doesn't throw very hard. The first two pitches, you know, they just work on stuff. They tell you what's coming. And that's just good. They're just trying to get their work in. We're trying to see some pitches. And then face Byung-Young Kim. I mean, just two guys that no one else in the world are like. Felt I swung the bat very well today. You know, I was the mature, wily veteran and just, you know, hey, I'm just getting a good look at this guy. Just tracking the ball. You know, that's what guys say, veteran guys will say anyway, that when they, you know, don't feel like swinging. But you know, it really is a good drill to see some pitches, see as many pitches as possible early on in spring training. Saturday. Today we hit off Curt Schilling, who, you know, is Mr. Savior in Boston, evidently. And most pitchers just kind of get the work in. They tell you what's coming, and they just kind of honor that, that understand that the hitters have only been here a day. Well, he's not like that. He doesn't tell you what's coming, and he's trying to have all his best stuff out there. You know, whatever works. So, but it's definitely not the most comfortable thing as a hitter. So whatever, it doesn't matter. It means nothing. The only reason if it's of note is because it was against the guy that's supposed to lead him to the promised land. Here I'm on Fort Myers Beach. This is the part of spring training that always seems kind of weird. You're amidst people who are enjoying themselves, relaxing on vacation. And you're here because your job brings you here. And that you have to go work and try and earn a spot, actually earn the job that you desire. It's always kind of weird that there's so much more riding on this trip to the beach, so to speak, than a trip to the beach.
We'll be checking in with Adam Heisdew as the April 4th cutdown day approaches. Our series is produced by Mark Moran of station KJZZ in Phoenix. You can share your comments with Only a Game by writing to us, care of WBUR-FM, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215, or by emailing oag@wbur.bu.edu. Please let us know on which station you hear Only a Game and how to pronounce your name. You can leave comments on our listener line by calling 617-353-1860. You can visit Only a Game's website at www.onlyagame.org. You're listening to Only a Game. During last week's program, Charlie Pierce and I discussed the sad state of the Chicago Blackhawks, and Charlie mentioned that Chicago was one of the original six National Hockey League teams. John Wild, who hears Only a Game on WEPR in Greenwood, South Carolina, emailed to correct that impression. When the NHL was formed in 1917 with five charter teams, he wrote, Chicago was not one of them. The Canadiens are the only original team left bearing their original name. Len Schwartz, a WBUR listener, was dismayed by last week's program because, quote, the Yukon Quest came and went, and Only a Game did not mention a word of it. Now the 2004 Iditarod has started, and Only a Game did not mention a word of that. I'll bet you that pro athletes in the NFL, NBA, Major League Baseball, and the National Hockey League would not last 2 weeks out in the bush. It would be nice if someone noticed how much work mushers put into their sport. David Freeman Wolpert, who hears Only a Game on New Hampshire Public Radio, was moved to write by Karen Given's story on pole vaulting on last week's show. As I listened, he wrote, I recalled my long-ago college roommate George Coghill, who set the school's pole vault record. The poles didn't really bend much in those days, and my roommate had one arm that was almost useless due to a childhood deformity. Even so, he set a record that stood for 5 years. I will always remember his confidence and tenacity. Thank you for reminding me of a wonderful and influential friend. Lois Butterfield, a frequent correspondent from Ithaca, New York, emailed, "I enjoyed your interview with that young Boston College hockey player. I offer the following suggestion to help him fight off the end of the season blues. How about a stroll up Huntington Avenue to check out the Museum of Fine Arts, or perhaps he could head for the beach at Duxbury or Plymouth and listen to the lap of the waves." Finally, in my conversation with author Thomas Hauser last week, Mr. Hauser characterized boxing promoter Don King as, quote, Shakespearean. I asked Mr. Hauser if he had Iago or perhaps Shylock in mind. Francis Quint wrote to say he was, quote, frankly surprised and disappointed to hear Bill Littlefield link Iago and Shylock as if there were similarities between them. Americans in our day shouldn't accept Shakespeare's anti-Semitism. If you wish to drop in like the gentle rain from heaven on that or any other matter, our email address is onlyagame@wbur.bu.edu. You can also reach us by visiting the website onlyagame.org, or you can write us at Only A Game, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215, or call the listener line at 617-353-1860. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR in Boston, where Only a Game is produced. Additional support comes from Thermo Electron, the scientific instruments company with a mission to advance drug discovery, improve manufacturing, and protect people and the environment, on the web at thermo.com. And from Hotel Commonwealth Boston, located in the Fenway Park neighborhood, near historic mansions, universities, medical institutions, and cultural sites. Information at hotelcommonwealth.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, tall tales of a co-ed all-Native American professional softball team. But first, the news of the week with Charlie Pierce. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
It's been 4 years since Marty McSorley, a thug with the Boston Bruins, whacked Vancouver Canucks tough guy Donald Brashear in the head with a hockey stick, and apparently it was time for another National Hockey League disgrace. Enter Todd Bertuzzi of the Vancouver Canucks, who broke the neck of Colorado Avalanche player Steve Moore on Monday night. Bertuzzi has been suspended and fined. We would have expected no less. The team has been fined as well. Has justice been served?
No. Todd Bertuzzi should be in jail. I don't want to hear any NHL apologists tell me about it. It's all frustration and bubbling over and part of the game. This guy could have died.
Absolutely.
And had he died, would we still be having this discussion? Skated up behind him, punched him from the blind side, jammed his face into the ice, and broke his neck. This guy should be, at the very least, convicted of criminal assault. Perhaps not literally in jail, but he should have a felony conviction on his record. And I believe his NHL career should be over.
Charlie, every time something like this happens, spokespersons for the NHL say there's no place for this sort of violence in the league in our game. Is there any reason to believe them this time around?
No. To paraphrase my man Jack McCoy's favorite line, intent follows the fist. If I knock somebody down, chances are 9 times out of 10, the only thing that will happen is they'll get up and kick my butt. If I knock somebody down and they fall into the river and hit their head and drown, I go to prison. It doesn't matter how guilty his heart was. It doesn't matter how thoroughly his emotions took him over, which is really kind of funny for a man his age to be arguing. The guy should have a criminal conviction on his record.
Tanya Harding is apparently undeterred by pro hockey's violent side, Charlie. She recently signed a one-game contract to play for the Indianapolis Ice of the Central Hockey League. If you had been in Indianapolis last night, would you have bought a ticket?
What I want to know is, did the Indianapolis Ice give her Manute Bol's old jersey?
Because it didn't need to be washed.
Because
two
years ago, he played for the Indianapolis Ice. It's only a matter of time before Tanya Harding has played every sport.
Conference tournaments are ongoing everywhere in the country. This is basketball we've switched to now. Which results have caught your attention?
Well, obviously the result that knocked my own alma mater, last year's Final Four participant, out of the NCAA tournament, setting up a huge NIT matchup between Marquette and University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee at the Bradley Center next week, I'm sure. The obvious one, of course, is that Xavier handled the heretofore undefeated St. Joseph's Hawks as easily as they did. I got to tell you, that is a very tough first-round matchup for a number one team in the country to have to play. Xavier's a good ball club. To have to play Xavier in Dayton, Ohio, is a really, really – I mean, what does a number one seed mean in that league?
On the pro side, in leading his Cleveland Cavaliers past the Atlanta Hawks on Sunday, LeBron James scored 34 points. That marked the 10th time this season in which he's poured in 30 or more. Everybody knew that he would be good, this quickly?
They've squeaked right now into the playoffs, and if the Cavaliers make the playoffs and LeBron James makes any noise at all in however many series he may be in, then you're going to see the comparisons go into the red zone again, because you will be looking at something that's paralleling the career of Michael Jordan at a similar point.
Senator and soon-to-be Vice President McCain.
Yeah, right.
Threatened legislative remedies if Major League Baseball does not soon implement a comprehensive drug testing plan. What, if anything, can be done by Congress regarding this issue? Or should Congress just stay out of it?
Here's the senator's problem. There's nothing he can do. He's sort of using the bully pulpit to bring public pressure to bear on the Players Association to reopen the collective bargaining agreement to put in a stronger drug testing policy, which they won't do, because, quite frankly, public pressure hasn't meant anything to the Players Association so far. It won't subsequently. I love John McCain. I've spent a lot of time with John McCain. John McCain is as close as I get to anybody I write about. This is a show pony move. This is a move by which you show the world that you're concerned about this allegedly serious problem.
Arnold Schwarzenegger doing his part in this matter, sort of. Has he forgotten that he's part of government when he says government doesn't ever do anything right?
Well, I mean, his own presence in the governor's mansion in California is proof enough of that. This is one, I think, that Governor Gropinator should just pretty much stay out of, given where he made his previous living and made his fame and fortune prior to his movie star fame and fortune, his Kennedy marrying fame and fortune, and his gimmick governorship fame and fortune. He should probably give this one a good letting alone.
And as I understand it, Charlie, it's not entirely in the past. He still owns a part of this traveling weightlifting, bodybuilding, and supplement show.
All of which is done, by the way, on red meat and prayers and clean thoughts.
In a critical baseball story, some Red Sox fans have asked the Boston Archdiocese to relax the rule that says Catholics can't eat meat on Good Friday, since there's a game at Fenway that day, and the fans want to eat hot dogs at the game. My understanding is that the fans may have to take their case all the way to the Pope on this one.
Would it be unkind of me to point out that I think the Boston Archdiocese was perfectly happy to answer any question that didn't begin with the clause, to the best of your recollection at this point? Why would you even ask? Go eat the hot dog. Go to confession. Move on.
A lawsuit filed on Wednesday charges that O.J. Simpson has been pirating a satellite television signal. This sounds like a Saturday Night Live update item. Oddly enough, Johnny Cochran's name is not mentioned in this story. Where is he?
But luckily, O.J. has committed himself to going down the street and finding the people who are actually doing the pirating.
So it's just a matter of waiting to see
what
he turns
right
up. Okay. Scandal rocked the dog show world this week, Charlie. Clive and Nancy Evans, owners of a Doberman named Carrie, whose eyes glazed over and whose legs were wobbly at Britain's premier dog show, claimed their potential champion was fed meat laced with tranquilizers. Is nothing sacred?
It's been dazed and confused for so long, Bill, it's untrue.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine, and of course he joins me each week at this time. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill. But the night lights and my dog's lap aren't exactly one and the same. You cultured killed my dog, and I don't think it's fair. And the judgment made in the city of hate just broke his spirits out.
Vin Baker, who was suspended and then cut loose by the Boston Celtics earlier this season for violating the conditions of his alcohol treatment program, signed with the New York Knicks yesterday. Baker, a four-time All-Star, played with the Milwaukee Bucks and Seattle Supersonics before joining the Celtics in 2002. Arbitrator Roger Kaplan's decision on Monday to invalidate a league memo prohibiting any team from signing Baker before a grievance that he'd filed against the Celtics was settled made it possible for the 6'11", 32-year-old forward to resume his career. A shrike is a predatory bird that impales its prey on sharp thorns or on the spikes of a barbed wire fence, except when a shrike is a member of the Lightning Shrikes, the co-ed softball team in a new novel of the same name by Devin Mahisua. The softball-playing shrikes are an unlikely mix of athletes culled from a variety of disciplines. All they have in common is that they are all American Indians. Devin Mahisua joins me now from the studios of KNAU in Flagstaff, Arizona. Devin, welcome to Only a Game.
Well, thank you.
I understand that you are an accomplished athlete yourself, and your sports include swimming, tennis, distance running, not to mention mushing sled dogs and ski-juring. Why did you choose to set your novel in softball?
Well, this was a great opportunity to show that tribes are not alike, natives are individuals, and this seemed a really good forum to do that. And then to have a variety of crises. And I thought one of the best crises might be that they're all great athletes, but they've never played ball before,
so
with the exception of one, yes.
Yes, there is one former major league ball player.
Mm-hmm. Sam Blue Eyes.
Tell us a little bit about his experience, because I think that's critical.
Well, Sam Blue Eyes is a Yaqui, and like lots of indigenous peoples in this country, Sam grew up in an impoverished background, and so he's very insecure on a lot of levels, and he's very angry. And so despite the reality that he's a very accomplished baseball player and he was very successful, he had difficulty controlling his anger. And he ended up being fined repeatedly because he was constantly getting into fights. And he finally was let go. He was very sad about this, of course, but the reality is that a lot of natives have a very tough history behind them. And so when Conley King comes along and asks him if he wants to join the Shrikes, Sam Blue Eyes isn't quite sure about it because it is a co-ed team, but I think that Sam sees this as an opportunity maybe to redeem himself a little bit.
The interesting thing to me about most, if not all, of the Shrikes is they're all pretty successful before Conley comes along and offers them the opportunity to play pro softball. It's not that they're desperate for money. They've got some pretty good things going.
I have had enough, really, with Native literature that presents characters as alcoholics or living in poverty, or else they live on a dirty reservation and they have little self-esteem. A lot of times we see Native characters in literature that are buffoons, or else they're a wise old grandpa who can talk to animals. And that's that last one is really a problem in children's literature, and that's a whole story in itself. And so what I want to do is to present role models. And they may be flawed, but they don't wallow in their flaws. I want to find hope in stories about Native peoples. And I also want readers to know that we're alive, for one thing, because I think that most people, most Americans, think that Natives live in the past, and perhaps they're all like the characters in Dances with Wolves. but we're living on our own terms and can be strongly connected to tribe, to family, and community. And so much literature has a hopelessness to it. And so I wanted to show that, you know what, these Native characters, again, they may have some flaws, but they are going to be successful because they can be. And there are hundreds of thousands of successful Native people in this country, but we don't ever hear their stories.
One of the conflicts that comes up at several points in the book is between the players, the Native Americans, and the white world in which they are playing their game. But another of the conflicts that may surprise people, there are an awful lot of conflicts between the tribes that the players come from individually.
I think one of the most common misconceptions that mainstream America has is that all Indians are alike. But these people, they speak different languages. They have different religions. They have and had different ways of dealing with non-natives. And so much so that they are, in effect, as different from each other as, say, Europeans are from each other.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a Swede is not an Italian. And so natives do have conflicts among each other. And so this is one of the crises that sort of the hero of the story here, Conley King, was very concerned about right from the beginning is, all of these people are from different tribes. And in fact, he makes a statement in there that his sister had served on the American Indian Center of Oklahoma City. And she was always coming home with stories about just the fighting and the arguments they would have, because every tribe has really its own interests. And so that's the same thing here with these characters. They are not at all alike by any means.
you are determined, it seems to me, to avoid stereotypes of the natives in the book. And that, of course, is understandable. But one of the Anglo characters, Darla, who keeps company with a powwow dancer turned ball player, is an absolutely stereotypical dumb blonde. She doesn't get jokes. She spends like a sailor with her credit card at the mall. Were you trying to even up the score there?
Well, her boy toy, Kramer, is actually a stereotype as well.
He's the powwow dancer.
Yes, he's the tall, handsome, fancy dancer. He walks in with his shades, you know, inside when he doesn't really need them. And he's not quite as smart as one would like him to be. I think native readers might pick up on some stereotypes in there. But yes, Darla, she's not exactly fiction. You know, I've seen plenty of Darlas hanging around.
Well, the specific comparison you offer, at least in visual terms, is Tammy Faye Baker. You say they use roughly of the same amount of eye makeup.
Yes. Yes. It's because I've seen her. You know how us fiction writers are. We pull from reality, and there she is.
I have no trouble with the message and with the politics, which are right up front, I think, in this novel. But I did find myself thinking, as I read The Lightning Shrikes, that you wanted perhaps to de-emphasize via absurdity the softball itself, that the softball was the less important thing. The Shrikes win every game they play during the regular season. That's unlikely enough. But beyond that, you write things like, quote, "We won by 3 points." I mean, softball teams score runs. They win by runs.
Did it say that?
Yeah, this team won by points.
Oops. Well, I had a few things in there. I was trying to figure out this triple play.
That's a bad one because it ends at first base. It's just not going to happen.
Well, I redid it and got it right, and I reread it, and I just don't think the copy editing was in there correctly because I went back through my notes. I had note cards laid out, and everything was arranged as to exactly who was doing what and what was going to happen. It's inevitable. You know, every time one of my books comes out, I read it and think, oh, my gosh, where did that come from?
I don't want to give away too much of the plot of the novel, at least not any more than I've already given away. But the final sentence of the novel refers to, quote, "white Americans again misunderstanding us Indians." And, of course, your narrator is an Indian, the manager of the team. Did you mean that as comic, or was there meant to be a bit of a bite there? And can fiction ever change that condition?
Well, the reason I put that in there was I am thinking in terms of the standards and what is it that everybody aspires to. Many people aspire to making lots of money. They want to be well-known, like a lot of our pro athletes. They really want to be on the cover of Sports Illustrated and make how many millions. But that's not what the Shrikes really wanted. You know, granted, everybody wants to have financial security, but they were more concerned about image and how it is that they can now be role models for other Native people, you know, these young Indian people growing up. Who do they have to look up to? So here, when the other restaurant patrons raise their glasses and salute, they are thinking, wow, look at all this money they made and look how successful they are.
Mm-hmm.
And here the Shrikes are thinking, wow, look at what we have done to educate people about Native America.
Devin Mahisua, professor of Applied Indigenous Studies at Northern Arizona University, is the author of The Lightning Shrikes, published by the Lions Press. She joined me from the studios of member station KNAU in Flagstaff, Arizona. Devin, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you very much.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is Boris Trapochki. We had help this week from Dave Reek at member station KNAU in Flagstaff, Arizona. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a tape of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287, toll free. CDs and cassettes are $15 postpaid. That's 1-800-909-9287. 909-9287. If you'd like to hear any part of this program again, sign up for the Only a Game newsletter or learn more about the Lightning Shrikes, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. Our final word comes from Devin Mayasua, who favors protective equipment.
So I just think mouth guards. I'm all for them.
Well, yeah, but not when you're doing radio. I mean, unless you're getting sound from right behind the batter there, but that'd be silly. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Major support for Only a Game comes from Bicon Dental Implants, offering discerning patients a same-day tooth replacement solution for failed root canal treated or missing teeth. Information is available online at Bicon.com or at 800-88-BICON.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.